Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk as part of the Contemporary Issues in Child Protection seminar series. This talk was recorded on the 29th of March 2011. Janice McGee, Senior Lecturer, and Lorraine Waterhouse, Professor at University of Edinburgh, Anxiety and Child Protection, Implications for Practice.
This morning, as Fiona said, is more an opportunity to have a discussion. So I think Lorraine and I just want to play about with some ideas with you this morning rather than a kind of formal lecture. But we'll just outline some of our thinking and ideas that we've been using and thinking about this issue of anxiety around child protection and what might be some of the implications for practice. So we're very much looking forward to having an opportunity to have some discussion with yourselves who are on the day-to-day front line of practice in this area. And I think it's probably very timely given the review that's been conducted by Eileen Munro in England, looking at the way the child protection system is currently structured and some of the strengths and some of the weaknesses and difficulties that it presents for practitioners. So today we're going to talk about anxiety. I just put this kind of definition from the diary, the dictionary, to focus us a little bit. I suppose in many ways, you know, there is long-standing interdisciplinary and interagency collaboration in child protection. In many ways, it's yourself as the frontline practitioners, social workers, health visitors, who really bear the brunt of the many of the stresses that arise from contact with children and families where there are concerns about abuse and neglect. And we know from the formal inquiries into child deaths and also from recent research that we've looked at and practitioners talking about their own experiences, the kind of increasing importance that's attached to anxiety. I think it was Andrew Cooper who said that really following all the various inquiries that anxiety has been one of the primary forces acting on the social work profession and no doubt other professions as well. I just looked through the research to see what had been identified as the kind of sources of anxiety in child protection, and obviously one of the key ones, you know, which is facing you day to day is that uncertainty in decision making. You know, because if you remove a child from the family, in a sense you're depriving them of their family experiences, but children who perhaps are not being cared for properly within their families, in a sense, are being deprived within their families. And that's, I guess, that kind of continuing tension of are you making the right decision, both in short and longer terms for children. I suppose increasingly the kind of negative media reports, and we've particularly seen that in the case of the baby Peter, you know, where social workers' names were actually in the press. And I think I know certainly from research, social workers are talking about their concern about this and about their sense of responsibility of protecting children from serious harm. So I think that's another perhaps source of anxiety in practice. Stanley and Goddard did a survey of practitioners and identified that some practitioners' own childhood experiences, in a sense, some of those feelings were reactivated when they were dealing with the consequences of children who had been harmed. I think increasingly the fear of personal threat to social workers in their day-to-day practice. This study by Jones is a kind of workplace survey of right across professions. It's not just the public sector. But they certainly found that there were higher levels of reported assaults for staff in health and social work settings. It was about three times the average across other areas. So I guess we see these our potential kind of naming different sources of anxiety. I think what we wanted to talk about a little bit was also the kind of context of child protection practice. I think, and you'll be living that day-to-day experience if we're not wrong, is the work intensification that has arisen with higher workloads, higher caseloads, higher levels of referral. And it's not just happening in the UK. The study by Kim was actually of social workers in California. And they surveyed over 400 social workers across a number of settings and certainly found that workers in child welfare had much higher levels of emotional exhaustion than social workers in other areas. And I guess that's reflected in the very high turnover in child welfare, and again, not just in the UK, but found in Sweden and in the States. I think the other area, and I'd be interested to hear your ideas about this, that Lorraine and I have thought about, is really that the very high levels of social and economic disadvantage that many families face that you're working with on a day-to-day basis. And there's certainly systematic evidence to show that families where there are child protection concerns certainly coincide with social and economic disadvantage. So, for example, if you look at rates of referrals, they're closely associated with child welfare referrals are closely associated with levels of economic and social disadvantage. And I guess also the second part of the context is obviously the anxiety about child deaths related to child abuse and neglect. And the World Health Organization actually looked at, right across internationally, at the kind of violence that children were subjected to, not just within families, but in across a whole range of settings, both institutionally, child soldiers, you know, taking that international context. And they found that roughly about 0.6% of all the deaths of children under 15 years were due to abuse or neglect. Obviously, the figures in the UK are contested, and there are different perspectives and different ways of counting. But I thought this might be interesting, that this was an article by Pritchard and Williams, who had actually looked at the number of child abuse-related deaths in England and Wales, they found they had actually declined, which in a sense they were arguing was because of the effectiveness of the child protection system. Though others would argue that there is likely to be under-reporting. So there are clearly a number of areas which can create anxiety in the day-to-day work. And I think our starting point today really was looking at quite an old study that was done of the nursing service in a London teaching hospital in the 1970s by Isabel Mingus, who worked at the Tavistock Clinic. She drew upon sort of psychoanalytic perspectives. So that's our kind of starting point today. It was a classic study of the organisation of nursing and of patient care in this London teaching hospital. And what they were trying to resolve was, why was there a very high attrition rate amongst nurses and nurses in training? They were investing a lot of money, but then a lot of people weren't completing their training or completing and leaving shortly afterwards. And she set it in the context of thinking of the nursing service as a social organisation, and that a number of factors interacted in that context. Partly there was a need for members of the organisation for social and psychological satisfaction, but particularly what she said was support in dealing with anxiety. And she talked about primary anxiety and secondary anxiety. What she meant by primary anxiety was the anxiety that rose for the nurses, who really are confronted with the threat and the reality of injury, of suffering and death, really as few lay people are. And that evoked very strong feelings in the nurses of compassion, obviously, of guilt, of anxiety, of envy of the care given to patients. And at the core of that anxiety lay in the relation with the patient. And I suppose what we are arguing in a way is that for social workers and other practitioners facing child abuse and neglect, that similar equally powerful kind of existential threats, powerful anxieties arise. Partly the level of the task, because you're working with children who are experiencing abuse and neglect, and with adults who fail to care for their children or to harm them. You're obviously, like nurses, facing the potential for child injury or disability or death. I think we would also argue, and you may agree or disagree, but in a sense, you're also seeing suffering in the sense of the limited kind of human and material resources that are available for many of the children and their families. And I think despite the getting it right for every child and the focus on the kind of ecological model, there's still a huge emphasis on risk assessment in child protection. And that's mainly focused on the kind of direct harm that parents or carers may present for the child. In many ways, the kind of poverty and social and economic realities have to be set aside, because you have to make a concrete decision within child protection. And then obviously that uncertainty about the decision. I think as Taylor in a study of social workers said, that it was a bit like the judgment of Solomon. You know, how do you make damage-free decisions in these contexts? The secondary anxiety, it was really how did the organisation of the nursing service, how was it structured in a way that managed that anxiety? Because there had to be a compromise between that core task of delivering satisfactory patient care and the implicit need, you know, it's operating on a kind of unconscious level, to manage the anxiety that nurses faced in dealing with suffering and death that were produced in a sense by that day-to-day task. And what you saw was a kind of socially structured defence mechanism, is what Mingus called it. That in a way that the service was structured in a way that both protected the nurses from experiencing that full anxiety. So you saw excessive movement of nurses. Nurses did not maintain, were moved around wards, they were moved around patients. So to minimise the kind of direct relations. And in a way, what we're arguing, I think, is to some extent that how the child protection system has been configured in the UK, what we have is a very highly regulated system of procedures to try and identify and to respond to children at risk of harm. We have guidelines, case conferences, core groups, sharing of information. And arguably, in a way, these procedures obviously allow for that sharing of information that's necessary, but in another way you can see them as providing a link to managing the complexity and the intensity and the anxiety raised by the work, because in a sense that the procedures create potentially a way of managing anxiety and fear, but at the same time it also operates to limit some of your professional discretion. It's a kind of alternative claim on time, and I think particularly has been identified in the Munro report, but the use of ICT and social workers increasingly spending more time in meetings, more time in front of computers, and having less time for direct work. And I think combined with the intensification of work, with the high caseloads, you're very much dealing with crisis and responding to crises. And the nurses, Menzies nurses, in a sense, identified the same thing, because they talked about always feeling this constant sense of crisis. There was a threat that there would be a sudden increase in work. They worried about not being able to carry out their work properly because of this work pressure. And although they were distressed, and it was recognised by the senior nurses that was in place, they didn't it wasn't expressing that distress wasn't encouraged within the organisation. And I suppose in a parallel way, you can see in child protection, there's been that work intensification. People may feel bombarded. It may overwhelm their capacity to respond to what are really multiple demands of the task. And that, in a sense, might also, inhibit the communication about the demands of the task and the difficulties that this might bring in forming productive relations with parents. Because the reality is this primary anxiety of the created by the task and the secondary anxiety in terms of the organisation of the nursing, but for us in social work and the child protection system, also primarily operate in that face-to-face encounter with parents. Because as social workers and as other practitioners, you need to form close relations with parents to see inside what's normally private family life. In many ways, we have to rely on families for information, because you can't observe everything on a day-to-day basis. Parents obviously, want to defend their capacity as a parent. It's a key identity role for all of us. So in that sense, you could see that both sides are scrutinising the other, and both are dependent on the other. And what Menzies was saying is that the closer and more concentrated the relation was between the nurse and the patient, then it creates more anxiety. And how the nursing service responded was to split the nurse-patient contact to protect the nurses from that anxiety. So they would do one task for one patient and then another task for another patient. And that, in a way, limited that kind of contact with the totality of any one patient. But in a way, had the seeds of its own destruction because it didn't really contain the illness that the anxiety, that the illness arouses. And in a way, you can see a parallel, perhaps, in child protection where there is more limited day-to-day contact with clients. Much of the time is spent in meetings with other professionals, in a sense, working within the regulations of the child protection system. And I guess I wonder, really, if that, in some ways, in the way that the nurses were split off from the patients by moving around, that in a sense the time that's invested in reports and sharing information and following procedures and professional meetings, responding to crises, because I think that's a general feeling that there is little less time for direct contact. In a way, is the child protection system splitting practitioners off from parents? And what is the impact on the relations? And Lorraine, I think, is going to pick up from here and say a few words.
Getting our papers in the right order. Good morning, everyone. It's very, very nice to meet you. And thank you for turning out. That's awfully, awfully kind and good of you. And it's really a privilege to have a chance to come and see you. And I think we both regarded this morning as a sort of mutual opportunity for consideration of these matters. I thought that really what I would just try and do, if I may, are to make possibly sort of three main observations in sort of sets, and to some extent it follows the overhead, and in other ways it probably deviates, so apologies firsthand for that. The three areas that I thought might be helpful to comment on, and would certainly welcome your consideration of them, is the first is just to go back a bit to this issue of what's at stake in child protection, and I'll come on to that. And the second area is, in a sense, well, what does that produce in a way? What does it require of everyone? And then the third is area is, well, what kinds of implications might follow from that? So three main areas, and I hope some relatively simple points. I've tried to think a bit about more, as you know, Janice and I did this writing, and subsequently with a little bit more reading since then, not as much as I would like. It's a myth that we get to read all the time in the university. We don't, so I don't know what it's like for you, but it's quite a struggle, even for us, and we're meant to be doing it as part of our job. So a little bit drawing on some other material as well. But I think the first thing to say is, of course, that in child protection, you're dealing with different kinds of protective issues, and we all know that neglect is probably coming more central stage again than it was, and also that a lot of the work, not exclusively, but I think quite a bit of it, may be done with women, mothers, in the day-to-day work that you carry out. So I suppose that the first observation, building on what Janice has been saying, is that in terms of thinking about child protection, you are at the forefront of working with a stigmatized population. The women are stigmatized, not least because many of them have very limited economic prospects for the future. Their education may be considerably less than your own. And then they have the added issue that they've come under the eye of the of social work, and that's got calling into question a further aspect, if you like, of their status, which I will come on to. So it's a stigmatized population that you're dealing with, and there are multiple reasons for that. So the background that you enter the stage on is hardly a neutral one in the first place. It's not always on side, if I could put it that way, for yourselves. So what is at stake in a way? Because when child protection all gets said and done, it comes down really in many ways, eventually, whatever policies may be there to assist, or whatever literature there may be or research to help, it usually involves, almost always, if there are reason for more serious consideration of concerns raised, an encounter between at least two people, sometimes more, but at least two people. And one of those will be the parent, the mother, and I'm going to just speak about mothers for the sake of simplicity for the moment, and the other is a practitioner, a social worker. Now, there may be other actors on the stage, but those two are almost guaranteed. So when the whole business of child protection is getting reconciled or decided, it involves two people coming face to face with each other, perhaps two people who haven't met each other before and some who will have a familiarity with each other. So from the perspective of the mothers, if I can take their perspective and try and imagine what's at stake for them when this encounter takes place, there are probably, I would like to suggest to you, three things that may be uppermost in their mind. The first is, and this is in a way got two edges, as it were, two sides to this coin, but I'm going to express it in one way. One of these three things, the first is going to be about family preservation. In other words, can they hold on to their children or their child? And family preservation is perhaps a sort of grander way of expressing this idea. The other second concern that they may have, depending on what's already happened, is can they achieve family reunification? If the children are away, can they get them back into the household? And the third aspect that, from the mother's perspectives, that may be on their agenda, is that there is some research to suggest not only sort of more recent sort of social science research, but also work that Janice and I did years and years and years ago, that would support the idea that one of the things at stake from the mother's perspectives, and it may be true for fathers as well, but I'm just going to talk about mothers, is that they have to protect a self-identity as a good mother, no matter the reality. No matter the reality, no matter what somebody else may say, but that deep inside the women, and it is argued by certainly someone who's carried out some work at Harvard recently, that perhaps these women, above all women, where in a sense their status is challenged on some of these other fronts, educationally, economically, and so on and so forth, that in a sense the one thing they have to preserve is their identity potentially as a good mother. And as I say again, in brackets, no matter the reality. So that may be something about how they, in a sense, come to this encounter, not necessarily having articulated this entirely in their minds, but it might influence how they approach, as it were, this other that is coming through their door. Because unlike the nurses, social work goes through the door, whereas the nurses were in their institution, as it were, protected by that environment in some ways, that social work extends. So you cross the threshold into this world of the other, of the mother that I'm portraying. So what will we say, what's at stake from the perspective of the practitioner? Well, there's plenty at stake there, most of which Janice has already covered. The first is error. In other words, you get it wrong. And there's some penalties, aren't there, around for that in the public media. Not very nice. And there's some penalties in the way authorities deal with practitioners when they get it wrong, which in my view have often been not less than sometimes helpful. So there's that. And I've put it first because, you know, it's kind of to hold up the flag, as it were, for practitioners sometimes. But there is another important one, and that is what Janice has touched on, the harm to child. In other words, that something really does happen. And that there is, at the worst of it, catastrophic harm to the child. And then the third is, what else is at stake? Censure, both public and professional. That having to live with the knowledge that others see the practice as wanting, or that you yourself regard it with hindsight as wanting. So there's plenty at stake. There's plenty to go wrong. And so this then, in a way, takes one to the second sort of, if you like, group of observations. So what does this add up to? What does this mean? What does this create? What sort of space, if I can put it that way, does this bring into play? And I think, in a sense, that almost all of these dimensions, these different perspectives, and probably more than I've mentioned, almost certainly more than I've mentioned, recognized or not, are under negotiation in the encounter that's about to take place as you cross that threshold, as the mother receives the other across that. And it seems really from the literature, Menzies being one very brilliant example of it, but there's other sociological literature around that goes back further than Menzies, that makes it reasonable to suggest that this creates an uneasiness by both parties, on both sides. A very reasonable uneasiness. Not just, you know, in a sense, an artifact, but there's a real basis for uneasiness, because something is at stake for both parties. But much of that uneasiness, I would suggest, and this is kind of my own take on it, but also draws from the literature, is really operating below the radar. It's there, but it's not to the surface in the encounter. And you could say, really, that when all said and done, both parties are sizing each other up, essentially. You're sizing up the mother and the child relations, but I would also suggest the mother is sizing you up at the same time, or it would be me if I was in as a practitioner, or Janice as a practitioner. And this creates what Goffman, as a sociologist, wrote about some years ago, what he called anxious, unanchored interaction. And that's really what I think is happening, or may be happening, at the moment this encounter takes place, because of what's at stake within it. Now, in thinking about this anxious, unanchored interaction, I think this is the process in which the real skill comes in for the professional is totally different than the lay person, because some of the crux of the development of productive relations with the mother, some of the ways in which relationship formation takes place, I think probably springs from, or is at least connected to, how one responds to and manages this undeclared, anxious, unanchored interaction. In other words, how do you make it anchored, less uneasy, and I would also suggest eventually above the radar in the interaction that takes place. And as Janice has said, I think that, in a sense, the professional skill of working with this element within the building of relations is really central. It's not simply gratuitous or a nice thing to do, because, as Janice has already said, in a way, you and anyone working in this field must rely on the parents and, to some extent, the children for information. If you don't get accurate information from them, they don't feel they can, as it were, give you the scoop. If they can't have candid conversations with you, then, in a sense, that is a direct block on your ability to know, in a sense, how the family is working, or probably may not be working well. So trying to think a bit about, so how does one work with this uneasy interaction and turn it in certain ways that might be at least create the environment, sow the seeds for the conditions that allow it to be transformed into something that is more anchored. I think there are probably sort of four points, and that takes me to the third of the three area sets that I wanted to mention. I think the first area that may contribute to transposing this interaction to something that has a greater sense of being anchored is the norm of fairness. That's probably the first thing, is to try, where I think that the social science literature suggests that that people will accept public intervention in their lives if they have a confidence, a belief in the norm of fairness that's being applied by the public institution carried out by their practitioners. And there are probably two particular norms of fairness which directly derive again from the work of Goffman that you might want to perhaps bear in mind as to how you can demonstrate this sense of fairness to the mothers. The first is to address why them. In other words, why have they been singled out in the community of otherwise disadvantaged families for your attention? And what we know in stigmatized populations is that Goffman describes that they have associational distancing. In other words, when a group are stigmatized what they do is say to themselves, but I'm not as bad as my neighbour next door. Why aren't you concentrating on Mrs. X next door or Miss Y next door? Because have you seen what she does to the bairns? That's really bad, but I'm not, in a sense, in that league. So one of the ways in which you can address this issue of fairness is, in a sense, try and explain why it is you are directly involved with them, because they will be actually comparing themselves to other mothers in the area and drawing their own conclusions about the fairness or otherwise of you concentrating on them. The second way in which you can augment fairness may be to address, in a sense, directly, firstly, why them, and secondly, why, in a sense, why you believe in the standards that you are expecting. In other words, the child-rearing standards that you are expecting. Now, Goffman also explains that in stigmatized populations, that a group who are stigmatized use a second device for managing the stigma, and that's known as institutional distancing. So the first is associational distancing from others, and the other is to distance themselves from the institution. And so that for some of the mothers, they may actually be disconnected from the parenting strategies that you're advocating. So a first-hand direct discussion about the kinds of standards that you believe in and that they may believe in, and getting that a little bit more to the fore. So that's the first. The second, really, after norms of fairness, is to consider the whole issue of the identity of the mother, the stigmatized identity of the mother, and to try and consider the benefits and disbenefits of how you can, in a sense, work with the mother in such ways that don't exacerbate the sense of the bad mother's identity of them, because the more that is emphasized, of course, the more the defensiveness of the mother is likely to be raised. So how is one, in a sense, to try and deal with the stigmatized identity that the mother may be experiencing? And that then is, how do you, in a sense, get into that dimension whereby you can recognize the difficulties that are arising in parent-child relations, but not necessarily a direct attribution to them as a bad mother in some ways, to be able to be mindful of the identity needs, is what Goffman would say, of the mothers when, in a sense, within a stigmatized population. And the third area that you might want to give some consideration to is, in a way, that if a population is stigmatized, their status is already in jeopardy. So what can you do to enhance status, their sense of status, in ways that are truthful, that are not a sort of, as it were, a false beckoning to them? And one thing that strikes me that may help with the identity needs of mothers in a stigmatized population is to invoke their participation in the child protection plans that you may be making. In other words, to try and devise those together. And that will also help to bring out the extent to which they are or are not connected to your own strategies for improving the environment for the child. And then the very final point that I want to make is that if there's anything in it, and there may not be, of course, you would know better, but if there's anything in it that a lot of this uneasy and anxious, unanchored interaction is below the radar, then one of the suggestions, I suppose, if you like, the kind of big message would be, as the professional and with this much heightened knowledge and expertise that you bring to bear over the layperson, is in some ways to bring it above the radar. In other words, to get it out in the room, in front of you, to help, in a sense, to help navigate that interaction in such ways that stigma is reduced rather than enhanced between you, and that gives the greatest chance for the development of a working bond with the mothers over the care of their children. So that's it, folks.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 2.5 UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.